defense was very good. They were very in tune on what we wanted to do execution-wise offensively. You know, we had some good looks at times. Some of the looks was a little bit tougher, but they had a good defensive plan, and they executed very well. They played at a high level tonight, and they've been playing extremely well at home. They gave us a good one tonight. But I don't know who we are or what we can be until we get IT back, you know, and consistently. You know, but we know what the program is, so it's not like a surprise he wasn't playing tonight. We already knew that he's not playing back-to-backs right now. So, you know, until we, you know, get a full dosage of IT and get our rotations down and things of that nature.
I just went up to block Horford's shot, got it, and came down and landed on his foot and rolled it. It was on the ground for a little bit, got back up, kept playing, came here right before the half, just tried to get it taped, loose, go out there, but I just wasn't myself. You know, it was definitely enough time, especially, as you mentioned, not playing until Saturday. I don't see any reason why I shouldn't play.
I will give Isaiah Thomas props because what he said was is that I didn't want to be restricted to limited minutes in my first game back, and I didn't want to have to go up against my old team not fully 100%. Okay, fair enough. I understand that because you got Kyrie waiting for you. If you're going to play one game, it should have been against Boston, not against Portland. It's nationally televised. It's against your old team.
They were in the paint all night. It's what we talked about before the game. So the ball was coming inside out of the paint. They just broke this down on the dribble, on kick and rolls and on drives. We could not keep the ball out of the paint, and that was the story of the game. I think the main thing was clearly 17 threes, and that was a product of the ball being in the paint all night long. We could not keep them out of the paint. You know, you got to live with that as a coach. You can't. If it doesn't work, it's a bad move. Put the heat on myself and take the heat. I mean, it's only good if it works. It's the first time I've gotten a technical, I think, in the league without swearing at somebody. It's definitely the first time I've gotten one for saying, come on.
Cleveland must have a quarterback after this draft. Quarterbacks are there to be had. You have to do a good job identifying them. Fortunately, the Browns had the first pick and the fourth pick. And it's not like they don't have picks in other rounds. They have a lot of draft picks. They got to find a quarterback. I wouldn't spend the first one on Rosen or Darnold. Darnold makes bad decisions. He's regressed. And Rosen, I think, has a good future. But that remains to be seen. So I think that a Baker Mayfield or another quarterback could be had later in the draft with the first overall pick. If it's not a franchise quarterback, it must be a perennial Pro Bowler.
In college, you're picking the talent. Now, I know Trent Baalke, he picked all the talent, had the dispute with Harbaugh in San Francisco. But they were talented. Offense, defense, it's not like Jim Harbaugh didn't have talent there. In college, you're the general manager. So he's picking all the talent. So everyone's like, oh, he can't get a quarterback. Well, you're recruiting him. If you sleep on the couch with a kicker, won't you just maybe pull up to the doorstep of maybe a quarterback? Jim Harbaugh is overrated as an offensive coordinator, is overrated as an offensive coach. Tell me, when was the last play that they run at Michigan, you're like, wow, that was a good play? Because I watched Oklahoma last night, and they ran 20 plays, and I was like, goodness gracious, that would be hard to defend. I don't see that with Michigan.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding day. Thanks for being with us. Is Chris Carter being an expert analyst? Or is Chris Carter just being an Ohio State grad who hates that team up north? Is he right about Jim Harbaugh being overrated as a coach? Is he right about Jim Harbaugh being overrated as a coordinator and a play caller and a play designer and a quarterback coach? Or is he just a proud member of Scarlet and Gray Buckeye Nation who doesn't like Michigan to be successful and is going to try to, you know, speak ill of them at any opportunity when they are not successful, as they were not this year? That's one of the questions to lead us off as we get rolling at 12 minutes after 3 o'clock now right here on the Extravaganza. Thanks again for being a part of our conversation. We'll welcome you to dial us up whenever you want at 866-240-1065. However, you must understand we do have a number of guests today. Coming up at 3:35, we are going to talk about a parade. Not just the parade, but a parade, because it's one of two. They're going to be held this weekend. I'll explain that in just about 30 seconds, because the other one is the one that is going to lead off our monologue. But Dennis Mandeloff will join us to talk about the 0-16 Perfection 2.0 parade that is going to be held around First Energy Stadium sometime this weekend. And it's going to be freezing out there. I don't know if they're going to draw more than 100 people, to be honest with you, but I hope they all stay warm by the dumpster fire floats that are going to be hopefully towed around on flatbeds around First Energy Stadium in Cleveland. But we're also going to talk to Maniloff, in addition to why Hugh Jackson is not being fired for leading the worst team in the history of the National Football League for 2 years, but also talk to him about that loss last night. You heard it in the montage. Cavaliers got smacked around ugly style by the Boston Celtics and Kyrie Irving. Obviously, Isaiah Thomas did not play. Was that the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? You heard Stephen A. Smith saying that he should have played tonight or last night as opposed to the previous nights if he isn't going to be able to play back-to-backs. I think that is just hogwash, garbage, trash thinking. Why should Isaiah Thomas, who's been on the shelf for how many months?
Seven months, Kush?
How on earth and why on earth would a guy who has been on the shelf, who's going to be rusty, who's going to be very, very difficult, it's going to be on a minutes restriction, not going to play the whole game. Why should he make his debut in his old building against the point guard for which he was traded? And be made to look foolish probably by Kyrie Irving at a time when everybody is, when two teams get together like this after a trade, what is everybody guessing? What is everybody evaluating? What is everybody trying to analyze? Who won the trade? They did it 10 minutes after the trade was announced, the announcement or the guessing game began. Who won the trade? Cavaliers or Celtics? Who got the better of it? The Celtics got Kyrie Irving, the best player in this trade, but the Cavaliers got IT, who is a really great point guard in his own right, and Jay Crowder, and we know about all the other ancillary pieces and parts. That's what everybody did right after the trade. That's what everybody was going to do in the opening game of the season in which the Cavaliers played the Celtics, but Thomas, of course, was not able to play. And now that he is back, barely, they wanted him to run out last night and try to prove that he's better than Kyrie Irving, which is what the whole basketball world would have been watching to see who was better and who won the trade. Not fair to Isaiah Thomas at all. Not fair to Tyronn Lue. Not fair to the Cavaliers at all. Times like this, you just want to tell people like Stephen A., you know what, just stop. Just stop. Think about it before you speak because this is not right. Pistons lost there too, but I'm not going to get into that very much right now. So what did I say? I left off with Maniloff. Coming up at 4:10, Anthony Broom will talk about the Harbaugh question for us. And with us, MasonBrew.com, is Jim Harbaugh on something of a hot seat at Michigan? And when I say something of a, I don't want to use the phrase hot seat as we have come to know it. Hot seat meaning, is he on the, bubble as far as being fired? Is it possible that he could lose his job? I do not believe it's possible or it's something that's even being entertained in the Michigan administrative offices to remove Jim Harbaugh's coach. Not at all. But it's a hot seat of sorts in that his reputation is indeed on the line right now. His job might not be, but his reputation is. He was supposed to go to Michigan to, bring back the maize and blue dominance of the Big Ten, the rivalry with Ohio State that has been lacking for the last decade plus, as Jim Tressel dominated the Wolverines, and now Urban Meyer is dominating the Wolverines, and yes, he is dominating Jim Harbaugh three times. It's just the way that it is. He was supposed to end all that, and he's not. That's making his seat hotter. Not that he's going to get fired, but that the reputation that he has built for himself as a great coach is really, really on the line, as you heard Chris Carter talking about. So Anthony Broom and I will analyze that. Coming up at 4:10, then at 4:40, back to college basketball as Coach Todd Kowalczyk stops by for his weekly visit right here on The Ticket to talk about mixed bag. They got a win over Penn, and then they got beat in their first MAC game of the season by Buffalo. High-scoring NBA-style affair, 104-94, so we'll get into that with Todd Kowalczyk at 4:40. Now, I mentioned another parade, and I said I'd get right back to it in 30 seconds or so. It might have been a little bit more than 30, but it's okay. Let's talk about the parade. The parade isn't the one that's going to be going around First Energy Stadium. This is a parade that's going to be held in Orlando at Central Florida. I got to tell you, sitting in Toledo, Ohio, broadcasting to fans of the MAC in large part, and we know, of course, there are plenty of Ohio State, Michigan, Notre Dame fans here, but it's Toledo. And BG, of course, being so close by, this is MAC country, not Power 5 football style. I'm very hesitant to say what I'm about to say, but I hope you'll accept it with the spirit intended. And the spirit is not to try to rip mid-major football in the country. It's not. It really isn't. But I'm trying to bring a voice of some sanity to the issue, the division, if you will, between Power 5 conference football and non-Power 5 conference football. Now, we know that UCF, University of Central Florida, did an amazing thing. They finished their season 12-0. Their regular season was 12-0. And nobody else in major college football and FBS did that. Then they played an SEC team that made it to the SEC championship game before losing, team that beat playoff-bound Alabama. Talking about the Auburn Tigers, of course, in the Peach Bowl, and they beat them. UCF finished the season 13-0 with a win over an SEC power? That's pretty damned impressive. And it should be held in the highest possible regard. Peach Bowl champions. They should hang a banner that says Peach Bowl champions. They should hang a banner that says undefeated 13-0. They should have a parade for the Peach Bowl champion 13-0 UCF Golden Knights. Nothing wrong with that at all. Fantastic. Good on you. But what they cannot do is what they're going to do. And they have announced that they are going to hoist to the rafters in the school's gym and display probably prominently someplace in the football stadium a banner that doesn't just say Peach Bowl champions, that doesn't just say 13-0. They're hoisting a banner that says national champions. They have declared themselves a national champion, and they are going to hold a parade and celebrate as such. They have changed their Twitter handle at UCF football to 2017 national champions. That's how they're identified now on Twitter. And the fact of the matter is, that's fraudulent. They're not the national champions. They were not named the number one team in the country in any polls, if we want to go back to the old style of deciding national champions. They weren't number one in the coaches' poll. They weren't number one in the AP poll. They weren't number one in the college football playoff rankings, and they did not make it to what we now know as the CFP, the college football playoffs themselves. They weren't one of the top four. So to declare themselves as national champions is fraudulent. It's not right. It's not something that should be allowed, and it's something that the NCAA should tell them that as a member school, they should recognize and respect and abide by the NCAA method of determining national champions. They can't just say we are this because we feel like this. What's to stop Clemson from saying we just had a bad day against Alabama? We were better than anybody else the rest of the season. We feel like we were the best team in the country. We're national champions. What's to stop them from doing that? They're holding a parade. They've changed their Twitter handle. Probably, I don't see them on Facebook. I don't really look that often, but I'll look, see if they're on Facebook. They've probably done the same thing, and they have just decided that we are the national champions. They've even created a logo to make it their own. And I've got a problem with this, because I'm just, and this is where I started out by saying that, sitting here in the backyard of not quite Power 5 conference football, you know, but with respect to the Mid-American Conference, I don't want to be too terrible when I say that's a different type of football that they play in their conference. The different type of competition underscores that. When you play the 86th toughest schedule in the country and go undefeated against it, congratulations on the undefeated part, but that 86 means something. It means something. Kush, how many Division 1A programs are there, FBS programs?
125-ish, 128, something like that.
128.
Something in that neighborhood, yeah.
You played 86, the 86th toughest schedule out of 125. You're not even in the top half, not anywhere near the top half. And that matters. I said before that UCF has done something amazing, and they have, and I give them credit for it. 2 years ago, in 2015, do you know what their record was at the University of Central Florida, Cush?
I do. It was a wild stat I threw out there a couple of weeks ago. They were 0-12.
They were winless 2 years ago, and that means over 50 players on this year's team went from the indescribably painful low of a winless season in 2015 to the euphoric high of an undefeated season in 2017. That's a really, really remarkable turnaround. And they want to be considered a power conference. They want to be considered the P6 team. A P6 team. Might not be a Power 5 conference team. We're a P6 team. P6 doesn't exist. P6 is not going to exist. Especially when P6 would include the types of teams and programs and schools that are in your conference. And I hate to say that again in such a rude manner, but UCF and South Florida and Temple and East Carolina and Connecticut and Memphis and Navy and Tulane and Tulsa is not P5 worthy. Just being real here. You're not a P5 conference. You're not a P6 conference. And therefore, as an undefeated team from a non-Power 5 conference, something spectacularly crazy would have to happen for you to be included in a four-team playoff. You weren't, and so therefore you are finishing your season at 13-0. You should celebrate it. You're finishing it with a Peach Bowl victory. You should celebrate that. What you cannot celebrate is a national championship that quite simply does not exist for you. And I've got a bit of a problem with this. And I want to offer this up as evidence of what I'm saying. Cush, what do we generally call schools like UCF, like Toledo?
Mid-majors.
Particularly when we see things like this happen. What happened to former Rockets coach Gary Pinkel? Got a better job at a Power 5 conference. What happened to former Rockets coach, BG coach, Urban Meyer? Got a better job in a Power 5 conference. We commonly call these schools and these conferences, we commonly call them mid-majors, as you said, Jim, but stepping stone schools, right? They're stepping stones for coaches to go from, you know, a mid-major job to a major job. People don't say, I want to end my career here. I've reached the zenith. Urban Meyer, coaching at Bowling Green, did not reach the zenith. He could have stayed the coach of BG for 30 years if he'd have wanted to. He didn't want to. Why? Because an SEC school came calling, and he went to Florida. Actually, that wasn't the order, was it? Did he go right to Florida from BG? Now I'm trying to remember the order.
No, there was Utah in the middle of that.
Utah, thank you. And then he went to an even bigger school and a bigger conference, and of course now at maybe the premier school in all of college football. Potentially, depending on your rooting allegiances and alliances. But they're generally called stepping stone schools. So here's what I would say to Danny White, the athletic director at the University of Central Florida, who is calling themselves the national champion, staging this parade, raising the banner, et cetera, et cetera. Here's what I would say to Danny. Danny, why did your coach, who led this resurgence from 0-12 2 years ago to 13-0 now, why did he just use your program as a stepping stone to get back into a Power 5 school, particularly his Power 5 school? It is his alma mater, and there is a draw there, of course. But they wouldn't have wanted him if he wasn't considered to be a very, very good coach. Why did Scott Frost just walk away from UCF if UCF was a national champion? Why did Scott Frost walk away from UCF if UCF played in a Power 6 school? Conference, I mean. A Power 6 conference. If UCF was on the level of, you know, Big Ten, SEC, ACC schools, if it was on that level, Scott Frost would have signed for a 10-year contract, kind of the kind Jim Harbaugh's got. He'd have said, this is it, man. This is it. I am at a Power 5 school or Power 6 school. We are a national championship team. We're a national championship contender. And I'm gonna. This is where I want to be. He didn't do that. He said, yeah, Big Ten just called, particularly Nebraska. Guys, I'm glad we're undefeated. I'll coach you in the bowl game, but I'm out of here. I'm stepping stoning up. I am using you as a stepping stone to rise up to another level. And it's because of that. If I had to say one thing to Danny White and one thing to the people down there in Orlando at Central Florida, the one thing I would say is if they're trying to declare themselves big time, trying to declare themselves the national champions because they went undefeated, and that they're undefeated means more than the other teams that had one loss, and so on and so forth, I would say how many of them have coaches that stepping stone them their way up to a better job in a better conference? Because that's not usually how this kind of thing goes. You make a lateral move. Or perhaps it might be an elevated move to go from an SEC school to a Big Ten school, a Pac-12 school to a Big 12 school. You might call those, I would probably call them lateral moves as they are all in the Power 5. But people don't take jobs at Toledo. People don't take jobs at BG. People don't take jobs at Miami of Ohio with the goal of making that their be-all, end-all career move. Unless, of course, they're just not really big-time coaches. And, you know, when I say big-time, I mean they're perfectly happy in the mid-major world, winning conference championships, hopefully making a bowl game at the end of every year and having an opportunity, and just being that part of the college football landscape. Nothing wrong with that at all. But if they want to be a national championship coach, you don't leave one of those to go to another school in a Power 5 conference. Scott Frost just left for that reason. Because he's not happy with just being, hey, we turned UCF around and we're happy to be a mid-major here doing mid-major type things, watching other teams in championships. I want to go be a play at a school in a conference where we can do those things, or coach at a school in a conference where we can do those things, and that's what he did with Nebraska. So I'm interested in your thoughts. If you've got them, share them. 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. We'll take your thoughts as soon as we can. Dennis Maniloff's going to join us after the bottom of the hour local sports center, and that is going to happen after we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day is a mystery to me because my computer just froze. There it is. Kansas basketball lost in Lawrence a couple days ago to Big 12 rival Texas Tech. Red Raiders were ranked, but it also makes Kansas now 0-3 this season in home games against teams from power conferences, as they lost at home earlier this year to Washington and Arizona State as well. That is a rare stretch for the Jayhawks, who in the previous 10 years against power conference teams at home, including Big 12 conference games, they were 101-3. They lost three games and 104 chances in such circumstances. Now they've lost three in a row. That is a wild stat indeed, your Buffalo Wild Wings wild stat of the day. We'll talk NFL football, NBA basketball, and a little bit more with Maniloff coming up next after the bottom of the hour Sports Center right here on the Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Right back indeed on the Extravaganza. Thanks for being with us. It's 3:38. We're going to take you until 5 o'clock in drive time right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. So they're hoisting championship banners down in Orlando. We'll talk more about that in a bit. They hoisted a championship banner out in Cleveland, too. You remember this? Right after the preseason, and the Browns went 4-0 and declared themselves, or at least many goofy fans declared themselves, to be preseason champions of the NFL. It certainly portended to be a great season for the Browns. This is something that was going to be a turnaround season. They really, really have it going now. I just remember laughing at these people at 4-0 in the preseason, and now that it's 0-16, well, it's time for the ultimate walk of shame. The ultimate walk of shame is going to consist of a parade of who knows how many, probably just a couple hundred, considering the temperatures are going to be below zero with the wind chill this weekend, circling First Energy Stadium to let the Browns management know exactly how they feel about 0-16 and 1-31 overall. The walk of shame for the worst franchise in the history of the National Football League. Joining us now to talk about that and a little bit more on the NBA last night with Kyrie versus not Isaiah Thomas is our friend Dennis Maniloff, who covers those teams out there in the city in the Northeast. D-Man, how are you, sir?
Hey, Bob France. How you doing? I hope you had a good holiday.
I did, my friend, and a happy new year to you. I always appreciate your visits.
You got it, bud.
D-Man, you tweeted something yesterday that I tweeted a response to, and I'm going to see if I can pull it up real quick. Nothing turns a page faster from 0-16 than said team having the numbers 1 and 4 picks in the subsequent draft. Parade? What parade? And while I certainly commend you for the optimistic sentiment on that point, you're right, they do have the first and fourth picks. I don't think you turn the page on 0-16 and 1-31 while keeping the same people in place. And yes, I know Sashi Brown is gone, but Hugh Jackson is not. You keep the same man in charge of a team that had the worst performance in the history of the National Football League over a two-year stretch. Then to me, I don't think you turn the page. And I don't care who you draft with number one and number four. And I think the parade is very well earned by the Browns management. They should see the shame that the people have of them up close and personal.
Well, I would agree with you that I would have turned the proverbial page on Hugh Jackson, okay? I am, to put it mildly, surprised that Hugh Jackson is still coach of the Browns, all right? My point, though, is that given what the Browns have in the draft, you've already got people starting to talk about, okay, what are they going to do with one? What are they going to do with four? What kind of permutations are there? All these guys coming out. It's draft season for the Browns already. That was the point. But I also want to say this. I don't think that a parade will change Jimmy Haslam's mind. You know what I mean? Haslam decided he was going to stick with Jackson. He's had a terrible ownership of the Browns. He knows that. I don't think he's going to maybe have the parade brought to his conscious mind and suddenly say, you know what? This protest is right. They are upset with me. I've had a terrible run. We're 1-31. I think I'm going to sell the team. Or I think I'm going to get rid of Hugh Jackson. So that's the point. I don't think the parade does anything, even though you want to take out your frustrations on what's happened. It doesn't serve really a purpose to me.
Dennis, can you find any argument at all to keeping Hugh Jackson as the head coach of this team? Is there anything that's legitimate beyond the argument that many people have made, and that is that Haslam has had too quick of a trigger finger in past coaching situations, and the one thing they have lacked among, well, in addition to wins, the thing they have lacked is continuity at the head coaching position. Outside of the, well, we shouldn't just make the change because we always make too many changes, has Hugh Jackson done anything in 2 years to warrant a third year on the job?
In my mind, virtually none. I couldn't justify bringing him back. I think he not only has done a terrible job as coach of the Browns, but he is openly politicked to keep his job. He is openly undercut people in the organization, specifically Sashi Brown. He made a slobbering fool of himself in Riverfront or in Paul Brown when he went over and hugged, McCarron for an hour and did that photo op. I mean, this is a guy who was shameless in his conduct to undercut the front office. Woe is I. I've got nothing to work with. Look what the front office did to me. Then he's throwing his players under the bus, the players who are there, who are busting their tails for him. He's telling them, well, you're not good enough, to win. You have to play perfect in order for me to win. So almost everything Jackson did, to me, warranted a firing after 2 years, especially when you look at the landscape in the NFL and you see some of the guys who got let go, such as Jack Del Rio, such as Jim Caldwell, whose numbers were, infinitesimally better than Jackson's. Having said all that, I can see where Haslam is coming from. You touched on it. Number one, the continuity aspect. Number two, he's saying 2 years ago I was lauded to the heavens for this hire. Everybody told me how great this hire was. And now all of a sudden this guy's junk. So I think, he's in probably denial about that, saying this, he could not possibly have gone from a universally lauded hire to a terrible coach in 2 years.
Dennis Manilov joining us to talk about the Cleveland Browns, who complete the almost impossible task of getting worse than 1-15. Damian, I mean, you think about that. They're averaging a half a win a season over the last 2 years. They're averaging a half win a season. You went 1-15 and said, well, at least we've hit rock bottom. We can't get any worse from here. And then 2017 arrives and says, hold my damn beer. Watch this. And that's exactly what they did here. I am tired of looking for optimism. I'm tired of looking for positivity. I have no reason to believe they will make the right pick with number one. I have no reason to believe they'll make the right pick with number four. They have given me no reason whatsoever to not just wash my hands of the entire sordid, disgusting, pathetic, historically bad franchise, Dennis. And I know I'm not the only one who feels that way.
I hear you, Bobby. Let me go back to one thing you were talking about, though, the 1-31. The great Daryl Ryder, well, we know our colleague over here, he pointed out that the Browns are a Jamie Meter blocked field goal from 0-32.
That's right.
Yeah, because that Chargers game, I'm almost positive that Daryl's correct. The Meter had a blocked field goal. Chargers missed a couple field goals in the fourth quarter. So
you're right.
It is remarkable. What's that, Bob? I'm sorry.
No, I said you're right. You're absolutely right. Your friend Daryl is right.
It's remarkable how close they came to back-to-back winless seasons. I never in a million years thought you could follow up 1-15 with 0-16. It's only been done once in the history of the NFL, and that was the Lions of 08. They got better, of course, real quickly after they drafted Stafford the next year. I hope that something similar happens with the Browns. But I get your point. I get fans' point. Skepticism reigns. People say, I don't care what they do, they'll screw it up because they're the Browns. I'm sitting here saying, you know, John Dorsey should not be held accountable for the past regime's sins. He should get a clean slate. But I've said that about other regimes that have come in here, and they've screwed it up. So I totally understand where the skepticism comes from and where the angst comes from about this franchise.
Dennis, do you think if that blocked field goal had not happened, and it really was 0-32 instead of 1-31, does Jimmy Haslam still keep him for a third year?
That is a fabulous question, Bob. I mean, it really is, because you would think, no. You think there's no way a guy could survive back-to-back winless seasons. But if Haslam's willing to keep Jackson at 1-31, what, you know, to quote a certain politician, what difference does it make on one win? So I guess I put the odds at maybe 50-50 or 50-50 that he would be retained, but that's a fabulous question.
Yeah, because that lets you know how absurd this really is, because if the answer is no, no way, 0-32, no way. No way anybody would survive that. Then why do you survive it at 1-31? Is that blocked field goal really the difference maker in the future of your franchise? That's amazing to me when you think about it in those terms. Dennis, let me ask you, again, I am in no way, shape, or form convinced that they are going to hit the home run that they must hit with that number one pick. Last night, or yesterday, Darnold and Rosen both declared for the draft, despite, of course, you know, fears that they both have that they could be taken. It's so weird. I actually joked on Facebook today. I feel very bad for both of those two guys because their next 4 months are going to be filled with fear and trepidation and cold sweats at night that one of them is going to be picked first by the Browns. They're going to go to the place where quarterbacks go to die and careers go to be destroyed, the way Deshaun Kizer's was before it ever got started. And so I feel bad for both of them, but they rolled the dice and declared and probably hope that the other one will be picked so that the loser of the battle will be the winner by going to the Giants at number two. So my point to that is there a home run there? Can you say definitively that Sam Darnold is going to be the franchise quarterback that salvages this wreck, or that Josh Rosen is? Or if you want to go crazy off the board and say Baker Mayfield or Josh Allen or somebody else is, the potential is there to draft the wrong guy very, very clearly.
Yeah, and listen, Bob, as a sports writer at the Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com, a guy who's, you know, been a fan of the game for 40 plus years, studied the game as best I can. I can't tell you who could potentially be a dominant player or can't miss. Or just the same in the same vein, I can't tell you a guy that I would say is automatically going to flop. That's where I think you have to, again, you have no choice here in Cleveland but to trust John Dorsey now. He's going to make that call. Even if Hugh Jackson recommends a quarterback, I have to believe that John Dorsey is going to say, look, I came in here with personnel power. I'm going to use it. We are going to draft this guy, and you are going to use him the way you need to, but he's going to be my call. So it's up to Dorsey to make the pick. There's going to be, you know, everybody's going to be dissected all over the place. All these guys are going to be picked and picked apart, and all the flaws are going to be exposed. But, you know, it's up to Dorsey to marry the raw skills to the player, to the system, to the city, to the weather, to the coach. All, you know, a million factors go into it. So I just punt on that one and say, John Dorsey, I hope you're right.
Dennis Maniloff is our guest. He announced himself as a sports writer for Cleveland.com and a Cleveland Plain Dealer. Real quick on the NBA. Last night, the Cavaliers had their second match of the season with Kyrie since Kyrie went and became a Celtic. Of course, we know that Isaiah Thomas did not play in the first game because of that hip. He did not play in the second game either, and he has drawn some criticism, as have the Cavaliers, for not giving Boston fans and a nationally televised audience what they wanted, which was to see Isaiah Thomas going against Kyrie Irving last night. Do you have any problem with the Cavaliers' decision on that matter?
1,000% no problems whatsoever. I mean, first of all, it's not our hip. You know, secondly, and it's not just any a garden variety minimalist injury. Okay, we're talking about a hip that required months and months and months of recovery, rehab, all the other stuff. You know, their strategy to play him against Portland and Cleveland. I like the idea they have him open at home. I think maybe they also planned it where, okay, we have the second night of the back-to-back. There is the built-in explanation that he shouldn't be expected to play back-to-back after a seven-month layoff. So we don't have to play him in Boston where, you know, it's possible he goes overboard and tries to do something just to show the Boston fans whatever, and he re-aggravates it. So I don't have any issues whatsoever with Thomas not playing. And by the way, Thomas was not the only one who didn't play last night. The Cavaliers did not play. They showed up in body only. They mailed that one in, and the Celtics punished him for it.
Why do you think that was, Dennis? Because you're right, it was very clear that that was the case. I was very disappointed in that, and I didn't expect LeBron James would allow that to happen. Not just because of the personal rivalry that has now been created with Kyrie Irving, and as much as it is an IT versus Kyrie, who got the better of the deal type of thing whenever IT is fully healthy and can play a full game and not a minutes restriction. It is also, and perhaps primarily, a LeBron versus Kyrie thing because it's perceived that that's why Kyrie left. I cannot believe that he wouldn't have had his guys, as he calls them, his guys, not Tyronn Lue's guys, his guys, ready to go all out in that game.
Well, I think there's several explanations. I mean, you know, you call them excuses if you're anti-Cavs, anti-LeBron, but I think you got a veteran group that's going to have trouble rebounding on back-to-back anyway. You have the fact that Portland forced them to expend a lot of energy on the first leg of the back-to-back. It wasn't a walkover in Cleveland. So, and then, you know, you go on the road for the second half of it, and I just don't think they had their legs. And here's another thing, too. If Kevin Love plays and shoots as poorly as he did, the Cavs' chances of winning diminish dramatically. And he was terrible at the beginning and then got hurt mm-hmm. on top of that. Love is a very important piece, especially with Thomas out. And he's been good on balance for the Cavaliers this year. But when he puts up a stinker, the Cavaliers' chances of winning go way down.
Don't disagree with that at all, 100%. Bigger picture now, looking ahead, based on the fact that Isaiah's going to come in and play and then not play on back-to-backs, he's going to see his minutes steadily rise. How do you see it all working out? Because when they had their best run of the season thus far, it was after Derrick Rose got hurt, obviously, because he's not helpful to this process, and it was with Jose Calderon playing the majority of the minutes at the point guard position. Now that guy is going to be Isaiah. And obviously, Isaiah is a much better player than Calderon, but he's a very much different player than Calderon.
Yeah, you say, how do I see it, Bob?
Okay. Oh, no, I was just going to say he's a much different guy because of, you know, shot volume and those sorts of things. So long-term, big picture, how long before that is all figured out and they get the maximum out of both of those guys at the point to win basketball games?
Well, assuming good health for Thomas. And, you know, you have to say this, you know, it's a precautionary thing. I mean, it's a hip, and it's not an easy injury from what we understand to come back from. So, but assuming he's okay and he's full bore by, let's say, I don't know, mid-January, they can turn him loose on a nightly basis. I would think it would take at least a month of regular play for him to get adjusted to LeBron and LeBron to get adjusted to him. I will say this. You know, some people say, wow, what's LeBron going to do when some of his duties are, you know, cut off from him or taken from him or reduced? I think he's really going to be happy that a guy can handle the ball on a regular basis. I know LeBron does it, and he's a point forward, and he enjoys passing, but I also think he would like to roam a little bit and, you know, work the baselines off the ball, set up shop for himself downstairs, you know, down in the low block. It's not like he has to have the ball in his hands all the time. And so I think he's going to welcome the relief that comes with a, you know, a guy who handles the ball on a regular basis, doesn't have to pass it because he's able to create off the dribble. And I think it's going to work out just fine. Now, will it work deep into the playoffs, especially in the defensive end? I have my doubts, but I think if Thomas is healthy, this team can be scary offensively.
Since you brought up playoffs, I'll just bring up a potential series against the Celtics. Based on what we've seen in two games, again, both of them without Isaiah. And of course, Gordon Hayward not going to be a part of that equation. But Cavs won the first one. Celtics blew them out last night in the second one. We still have a couple more matchups, I guess, in the regular season. But in a seven-game series, does Boston have a chance at upsetting the Cavaliers, or is it still Cleveland's conference?
I absolutely think Boston has a chance. I don't know what Hayward's timetable is. I think that could be an interesting element. I don't know. I haven't even checked if he's available, if he's going to be available anytime soon or by the end of the season, but I thought I read somewhere
I thought they said at the beginning he was done this season, and that means
let's assume he is done for the year. Even without Hayward, I still think they can make noise. LeBron said as much last night. He said they were a threat last year. They're a threat this year. They're obviously well coached. They have Kyrie. They have other components. Tatum's really, you know, he looks really good to me. They're gritty. They're grimy. They play good defense. They force you to take shots you don't want to take. So absolutely they're a threat. But I'll tell you this, Bob. The team to me that is just hanging around under the radar is the Toronto Raptors.
Yeah.
And I know that the Cavs and Cavs guys say, well, we beat the Raptors every time we play them or whenever it matters. But they're a scary group. I mean, if DeRozan and Lowry are clicking, that team is scary. And you look at LeBron's series since he's been back, his postseason series in the, you know, three previous years since he's been back, and one of the toughest that he got, other than the losses to Golden State, of course, was the one of the ones against the Raptors that went 4-2. So, and I think the Raptors are dangerous and nobody's talking about them.
I think they're going to start to get a lot more talk if they continue this, you know, past the All-Star break. I think you're exactly right. Dennis Manilov with some thoughts on the Browns' embarrassment, the walk of shame. Are you going to cover it for the paper by any chance?
By osmosis, Bob. No, I will not.
Dennis Manilov.
Somebody will, but not me.
Got it, D-Man. Dennis, thanks very much, my friend. I always appreciate the opportunity. Happy New Year again. We'll catch up again soon.
Thanks, Bob.
You got it. All right, 4 o'clock now. That means top of the hour and time for our top of the hour local sports center. But before I do that, Jim Cushlin, do you still have that pair of tickets that I saw laying around on the counter before for the Rockets basketball game coming up this Friday, which is tomorrow, at Savage against Akron? The club tickets that also include a parking pass for the game. Do you still have that there?
I do indeed, and this is a pretty slick deal because they're specific tickets with a parking pass. How cool is that?
That's outstanding. Club tickets that also include a parking pass. So if you've still got those, hold on to them. I'm going to give them away in about a half an hour right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Their defense was very good. They're very in tune in what we wanted to do execution-wise offensively. You know, we had some good looks at times. Some of the looks was a little bit tougher, but they had a good defensive plan, and they executed very well. They played at a high level tonight, and they've been playing extremely well at home. They gave us a good one tonight. But I don't know who we are or what we can be until we get IT back, you know, and consistently. You know, but we know what the program is, so it's not like a surprise he wasn't playing tonight. We already knew that he's not playing back-to-backs right now. So, you know, until we, you know, get a full dosage of IT and get our rotations down, things of that nature.
I just went up to block Horford's shot, got it, and came down and landed on his foot and rolled it. It was on the ground for a little bit, got back up, kept playing, came here right before the half, just tried to get it taped, loose, go out there, but I just wasn't myself. You know, it was definitely enough time, especially, as you mentioned, not playing until Saturday. I don't see any reason why I shouldn't play.
I will give Isaiah Thomas props because what he said was is that I didn't want to be restricted to limited minutes in my first game back, and I didn't want to have to go up against my old team not fully 100%. Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. I understand that because you got Kyrie waiting for you. If you're going to play one game, it should have been against Boston, not against Portland. It's nationally televised. It's against your old team.
They were in the paint all night. It's what we talked about before the game. So the ball was coming inside out of the paint. They just broke this down on a dribble, on kick and rolls and on drives. We could not keep the ball out of the paint, and that was the story of the game. I think the main thing was clearly 17 threes, and that was a product of the ball being in the paint all night long. We could not keep them out of the paint. You know, you got to live with that as a coach. You can't. If it doesn't work, it's a bad move. Put the heat on myself and take the heat. I mean, it's only good if it works. It's the first time I've gotten a technical, I think, in the league without swearing at somebody. It's definitely the first time I've gotten one for saying, come on.
Cleveland must have a quarterback after this draft. Quarterbacks are there to be had. You have to do a good job identifying them. Fortunately, the Browns had the first pick and the fourth pick. And it's not like they don't have picks in other rounds. They have a lot of draft picks. They got to find a quarterback. I wouldn't spend the first one on Rosen or Darnold. Darnold makes bad decisions. He's regressed. And Rosen, I think, has a good future. But that remains to be seen. So I think that a Baker Mayfield or another quarterback could be had later in the draft. With the first overall pick, if it's not a franchise quarterback, it must be a perennial Pro Bowler.
In college, you're picking the talent. Now, I know Trent Baalke, he picked all the talent, had the dispute with Harbaugh in San Francisco. But they were talented. Offense, defense, it's not like Jim Harbaugh didn't have talent there. In college, you're the general manager. So he's picking all the talent. So everyone's like, oh, he can't get a quarterback. Well, you're recruiting him. If you sleep on the couch with a kicker, won't you just maybe pull up to the doorstep of maybe a quarterback? Jim Harbaugh is overrated as an offensive coordinator, is overrated as an offensive coach. Tell me, when was the last play that they've run at Michigan you're like, wow, that was a good play? Because I watched Oklahoma last night, and they ran 20 plays, and I was like, goodness gracious, that would be hard to defend. I don't see that with Michigan.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed. Hour number 2 of the Extravaganza, 11 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thanks for joining us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader, and we ring in 2018 all week long with some really, really difficult coaching conversations. Jim Caldwell, Hugh Jackson, the Marvin Lewis thing, and now in a different sort of way, a coaching conversation about a college guy who is not on the hot seat in terms of potentially losing his job. But a guy who is on the hot seat, when it comes to losing his reputation, Jim Harbaugh was supposed to be the savior for the Michigan Wolverines. He was supposed to be the guy that restored them to Bo Schembechler and Lloyd Carr-type glory. He was the guy who was supposed to slam the brakes on this terrible skid against the hated rivals, the Ohio State Buckeyes. He was the guy that was supposed to return Michigan State to little brother status. He was the guy that was supposed to put James Franklin and the Penn State football team down to its proper place, which is behind Michigan in the Big Ten. He has done none of the above, coming off of an 8-5 season now. A season capped by a loss in the Outback Bowl to South Carolina after being up in the second half by 16 points. Is Chris Carter right about Jim Harbaugh? Is he the most overrated head coach? Is he the most overrated offensive coach, play designer, play caller? Joining us now to talk a little Michigan football and all of the strangeness going on surrounding the Wolverines right now is our good friend Anthony Broom from MazeandBrew.com, a site devoted to the Wolverines. Anthony, happy New Year to you. How are you, my man?
I'm doing great, Bob. How are you guys?
We are fantastic. Jim Cushland is here, of course, as well, and he'll chime in from time to time. But, Anthony, you know what struck me after Harbaugh's team coughed up the Outback Bowl and cost the Big Ten an 8-0 bowl season, which would have been incredible, wasn't, you know, all of the things that I had just mentioned. It was because it was later on in the day that Nick Saban beat the number one team in the country handily when Alabama beat Clemson, and I was reminded of the fact that Jim Harbaugh makes more than Nick Saban does. Jim Harbaugh makes more than Urban Meyer does, who the day before, on Friday, I should say, of course, won the Cotton Bowl for the Buckeyes, and has beaten Harbaugh three times now. You know, he's the highest paid coach in America, including over those two particular guys, and it's not looking like that is a very wise investment for the Wolverines, at least at this particular point in time. How do you feel about the fact that Harbaugh is paid as well as he is and is getting such mediocre to below average results?
Well, this is the thing. This is how I feel about the way he's paid. Obviously, the way he was paid comes with the expectations that, yeah, you have a coach on the level of a Nick Saban, on the level of an Urban Meyer. And quite frankly, you just laid the numbers out there. It hasn't been that. With that being said, I mean, that was kind of the cost you had to pay to get him. So I'm not going to knock him so much for what he's paid, but when you bring in a coach of, when you pay someone that much, that's the caliber of coach you're looking for. And I'm not, the most important thing for him is what comes next. I mean, the way they blew that Outback Bowl game was, that was extremely concerning to me. I mean, that was perhaps one of the bigger chokes we've seen. Definitely, that's certainly the worst loss of the Harbaugh era for them so far. A lot of people have a lot of questions right now, and I honestly can't sit here and say anyone's wrong about any of them because we haven't seen it yet after 3 years.
You know, you're right. It's not wrong. It's also, I think, still a little early to prejudge him as a bust, or not a prejudge, but to judge him as a bust as the head coach here. I guess my question is what did he do for the last month? You know, this wasn't, you know, a week after playing Ohio State and still a little bit down after the, you know, the emotional loss of losing rivalry game or something, and now they got to get up first for South Carolina. They had a month, like everybody else did, to prepare for this game, and that was the most pathetic offensive performance. And, I mean, they didn't look any better under Brandon Peters than they did under John O'Korn. There was no creativity. Chris Carter was right. There was no ingenuity. There was nothing that said, you know, look what we can do when given an opportunity to prepare. The offensive line was garbage. They couldn't run the ball. I think the leading rusher, Higdon, had, what, 60 yards or something? I'm just wondering, what exactly is that? You said, you know, this is what it took to get him here when it comes to his pay. What exactly is it that was worth paying to get here? I mean, does he have a history of offensive ingenuity and creativity and, that I'm not aware of and that is just not coming to light? Is that offensive ingenuity and creativity there, but he just doesn't have the horses to run it right now? I guess that's my big question here is I've changed my expectations. I don't know what was expected of him in order to lay out the kind of money that they are to keep him.
Yeah, and I think you sort of alluded to it. I think a lot of it, that offensive line was banged up, and they were down Patrick Kugler, and you know, they had some other guys banged up, and you know, when you sit here and you ask, okay, well, what are you paying for? What were they paying for? I think you're looking at, you know, what some of those Stanford teams ended up, you know, you had these big mauling offensive linemen, could run the ball at will, and you had a quarterback that, you know, could kind of take what the defense gives them and get the job done there. And Michigan doesn't have any of those things right now. And that's, you know, as we head into year four, why don't they have any of those things? I think is a fair question. When it comes to creativity, I mean, I think that there's a total, I'm not ready to put him on the hot seat. But it's getting a little warm, and it's to the point where, you know, they have to make some changes to that offensive staff, because now we're sitting here, year three is over, we're heading into the offseason, year four. The offensive line hasn't gotten better. It's only gotten worse. Quarterback play hasn't gotten better. It's only gotten worse. Your playmakers on offense, you weren't able to replace them, from last year's team. So it's a concern. I mean, you need to shake something up. You know, I think that shoe is going to drop soon. I do think some staff changes are coming on the offensive side of the ball. Maybe with Tim Drevno, but could be a couple of the positional guys too. I mean, I don't know how you can sit here and look at the film from this year and say that what that offense gave you, there was, you know, 8-5 is one thing. You know, we knew that this team, there's a possibility, a young group, they're going to take a little bit of a step back. You know, if you go 8-5, but you see things progress every week, that's one thing. But you can't honestly sit here and tell me that, you know, from that game the other day, going all the way back to the Florida game, that this offense got better, because in a lot of ways it only got worse. The run blocking, okay, those guys got better, but again, against the better teams they played, they still got punched in the mouth. So, that's a concerning thing. I mean, defensively, that team is, you know, as good as any in the country, as far as I'm concerned. But if you can't even be average to slightly above average offensively, which they haven't been, that's a problem. And changes have to be made because of it.
Will those changes be made at Harbaugh's request or at the athletic director's request against Harbaugh's wishes? Because, you know, obviously he gets to pick his staff. Do you think he sees this and that he will be saying, you know, we've got to do something differently here with these people you're talking about, or would it be forced upon him?
I do think it will come from him. You know, it's been 3 years now. They've had some staff changes. Obviously you lost, Tyrone Wheatley and Jed Fish after last year. I do think that played a little bit of part in this year, but, you know, like I said before, you know, 3 years, offensive line hasn't gotten better. It's only gotten worse. They've lost some battles on the recruiting trail, for some of those offensive linemen. You know, I think the sample size is there. I know Harbaugh isn't happy with the record. Nobody in Ann Arbor is sitting on their hands and saying, okay, well, let's wait till next year. Especially after, you know, you want your bowl game, you want the last month or so to preparation to be kind of a springboard into 2018 if you're not going to be playing in the college football playoff. And all this did was really create more questions and really maybe even crank the pressure up a little more. So I think as they wind down, they're going to look at the tape. They're going to look at everything from this year. And I do think that staff changes are coming. Yes. And I think it will be from Harbaugh. I don't think – first of all, I still think Harbaugh pretty much has carte blanche in that athletic department. So – nobody's going to force him to make any changes that he's not willing to make himself. So I do think those will come from him, and I do think we'll know more on that maybe pretty soon.
We're talking to Anthony Broom, MasonBrew.com, rather, Michigan Wolverines website. Let me ask one more, and I know Jim Cushman wants to get in here too. Brandon Peters was terrible. He had an opportunity, as we know, with Wilton Spate leaving and John O'Korn thankfully graduating. It's going to be a wide open quarterback competition next year. And the two front runners were thought to be Peters, and true freshman, Christian McCaffrey, who will of course be, he's a true freshman now. He'll be a redshirt freshman next year. And Christian McCaffrey. And then of course they signed, Joe Milton, a, four or five star, depending on the rating service prospect as a true freshman. Peters had a chance to really cement himself as the guy going into the spring with a good, strong performance, and he was terrible. 20 for 44, well below 50% completion percentage, 186 yards, so he wasn't even trying to get it down the field much. Two interceptions. How big of a step back is that for him, and does this really open the door for, like I said, somebody like McCaffrey?
Well, I mean, it's a big step back. I don't know how else to really put it other than that. I mean, I don't know if it was coming back from the injury or the offensive line, maybe take, you know, allowing some hits on him, but, you know, that's not the guy we saw. And I know he didn't throw that much when, he had those games against Rutgers and Minnesota and at Maryland, but, you know, this is a guy who was, he looked tentative, he wasn't going through his progressions. He wasn't making any reads. He wasn't, you know, it seemed like the ball was coming out pretty slow. I'm not sure what happened there. And I don't know if it's because, like I said, because of the injury, or I know maybe the Shea Patterson stuff with him transferring in, maybe in the back of his head. I know he came out.
Geez, I didn't even mention Patterson. I'm sorry. You know, I just glossed right over the transfer and went right to the McCaffrey card in Milton. I didn't even mention Patterson. Yeah, that's a big part of this equation, too. You're right. Yeah, maybe that put a little bit more into his head that he had to perform against South Carolina. Maybe that weighed on him a little bit. Please continue.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, he came out pretty strongly and said, you know, I'm not going to let anyone come in here and take my job from me. Well, I'm sorry, Brandon, but you may have just gave it to him, because that's not exactly how you go into an off season, place your stamp on a program and cement your status as, you know, a guy to look forward to. So I still think, you know, based on the flashes we saw before the bowl game, I still think there's something there with him. But, you know, after this transfer news, one of the immediate takeaways from Patterson transferring in was, okay, well, let's see what Peters does in the bowl game. You know, he has a real shot to maybe make this an interesting battle, cement himself as a guy that people shouldn't sleep on it. He didn't do that. In fact, it looked like more of the same. I mean, this is a Michigan football team that, as a team, only passed for 9 touchdowns this entire year between Milton Spaeth, John McCord, and Brandon Peters. It's not only is it not good enough, it's terrible. It's quarterback ineffectiveness that we haven't seen since that first year of Rich Rod. So, I did not expect that to be the case this year. I thought you'd see a little bit more from whoever was back there, but not only was it not good enough, it was straight up bad. So, they better hope that Shea Patterson can come into play right away, because right now, I mean, unless Dylan McCaffrey, now everyone's waiting to see, you know, last year's offseason, everyone's waiting to see what Brandon Peters was going to do. Now people are down on him. Now McCaffrey's the next guy. So we keep cycling to who's going to be that next guy. And, you know, after a while, someone's going to have to emerge, or else, you know, this isn't going to go the way that people were hoping it would.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. You know, Chris Carter, we played that clip there at the end. By the way, I completely butchered my question to you in two different ways now, because I think I called Dylan his older brother Christian. And, of course, we mean Dylan McCaffrey, the quarterback prospect, as well as forgetting about Shea Patterson. But Chris Carter said, you know, why don't you go sleep on the couch at some quarterback's house instead of some kicker's house and get yourself a playmaker here, because this is terrible. I feel like he has done that, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but first of all, he has convinced Patterson to come by way of transfer. Hopefully he'll be eligible. I think Dylan McCaffrey was one of the top prospects in the country over a year ago when he was deciding on his college and making his commitment. And Joe Milton is, again, a 4- or 5-star prospect. So it's not like he doesn't have talent at that position that he's unable to recruit. It's just a matter of finding the offensive game plan or, you know, strategy or whatever you want to call it. That just isn't working right now to take advantage of these guys' talent, whoever ends up winning that job.
Yeah, like they haven't, you know, when I go back and think about the guys that they've recruited at quarterback out of the staff, it's not like they've missed on someone. It's not like they, you know, missed out on a, you know, I know, I'm just trying to think of a hot freshman. It's not like they missed out on a Jake Fromm, like a guy who's at Georgia now. Yeah. They've gotten the guys they want. It just, you know, Peters is kind of that first guy. So that was sort of the first experiment, so to speak. Not going to really dog him for not being able to develop. I mean, I thought Wilton State, when healthy, was adequate. I don't have any problem with what they got out of him. John O'Korn was a reclamation project. Jake Rudock was a graduate transfer. Brandon Peters really is that first guy. So I'm not quite ready to say he doesn't have it and can't be something, but you know, with McCaffrey coming in and then Milton, and then we'll see who they have going forward, but what they're able to do. But I'm not – recruiting has not been a problem, really, at any position. Like I said, they've moved – they've lost some guys on the offensive line. Maybe that's affected them a little bit, but, you know, you got to coach up the guys you have. There are programs out there doing a lot more with less. So that's why, you know, I feel like there are changes to be made there, and I think they will be made.
Anthony Broom of MasonBrew.com joining us. I mentioned Jim Kushlin has been chomping at the bit here to get a question. And Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, I keep thinking about some of the other playmakers or lack thereof, you know, on this team. Where is Michigan's status in terms of, like, the backfield, some of the wide receivers, things like that, those playmaking offensive positions? Because, you know, we can talk about the coaching possible changes in the staff that we're talking about and the whole quarterback thing, which we're going over. But if you don't have anybody big-time quality to hand the ball off to or to throw to, it's not going to make much of a difference. Counting the recruiting class, where does Michigan stand on some of those types of guys?
Yeah, the skill, you know, skill player-wise, despite what we saw this year, I think they're going to be okay there. You know, Donovan Peoples-Jones, obviously, kind of an up-and-down year for him, but that's a guy who I'm actually downtown Detroit right now, right next to his old high school, Cass Tech. You know, when he was in high school, all he really had to do was, you know, balls in his hands, run. You know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, he's one of the knocks on him, he wasn't exactly a precise route runner, still had to learn some of the technical aspects of the game, and I think that at some point, with some more coaching, he'll be able to do that. Tariq Black was a guy, got hurt early in the year, Michigan's very high on, so, you know, you look at those two guys, I mean, you have your two wide receivers, I think you have your running backs. Caron Higdon, you still got another year or so of him. I think they've recruited that position fairly well. Now Kareem Walker has had some academic stuff and, you know, would like to see maybe an extended look from him, but, still, it feels like they have the guys there, and what's holding them back is really the offensive line play, like I talked about before, and, the ability or the inability to find a good quarterback. So, when I look at what's holding this team back offensively, you know, that's kind of where it is. Now, you know, maybe you're not going to have a dominant offensive line, but if you have a decent to good one, I think we could see some big things out of the guys they already have. So I don't think they're bereft of talent by any stretch, but, they need to get some more from some other people for sure.
We're talking to Anthony Broom of MasonBrew.com about the Michigan problem. They're 8-5. They finished the season 8-5 on a three-game losing streak to Wisconsin, Ohio State, and then South Carolina in the Outback Bowl. And a lot of people are not happy, and Jim Harbaugh has taken some heat from all sides, even from diehard Michigan fans who are very disappointed in what the savior has been able to bring now in three seasons going into this fourth off season. Just briefly, just because we're talking college football, Anthony, you watched the semifinal games, I would assume, the classic in the Rose Bowl with Georgia coming back on Oklahoma and then a really dominating performance by Alabama. Two questions. Number one, who do you like in the final? And number two, what do you make of Alabama now, given the fact that the Big Ten conference champion did not qualify for this top four, which would have been Ohio State, and a lot of people felt like they had a better shot, or, you know, they had a better claim to it maybe than Alabama did based on schedule strength and a couple of other things. Alabama didn't win their conference. They didn't even play in their conference championship game. But then they dominated the number one team. So who do you like, first of all? Second of all, did Bama prove the committee right?
Well, I would say yes. I'm proving the committee right. I mean, they were obviously able to get the job done. And, you know, I know a lot of people thought maybe Clemson would not beat up on them, but, you know, it would be another win for them for the second year in a row. But, you know, Bam proved they belong, or, you know, they belong there. And I felt they made the right decision. I mean, Ohio State, you know, I know they won the Big Ten, but, you know, you have a, whatever it was, 30 plus point loss to Iowa on your resume. I just can't put that team in the playoffs. I can't. So I think they made the right call. As far as a pick for that game, I mean, it's really hard to pick against Nick Saban, but I like that Georgia team a little bit more. Roquan Smith, the linebacker, is an absolute monster. But I mean, both, you know, there's a lot of NFL talent on both of these teams. I think I'd go. Oh, it's so tough. This is the first time I've been asked for my pick, so I'm kind of talking.
Well,
I'm filibustering here.
It's only 4 days
here.
Away, so we got to make that call.
I'm filibustering here, but I'll go with Alabama. I think that you know Jake Fromm might be the better quarterback between him and Jalen Hurts, but Hurts has played in a lot of big games already, and you know I think that's gonna be the difference in this game is which quarterback plays better. And I think that you know they have. Alabama is Alabama. I think they'll do it again. I think that, you know, this is kind of that, everyone wanted to see this matchup in the SEC title game. Well, now they get to see it for all the marbles. So, I expect it to be a really good game. Obviously one of those SEC slobbering onto the type affairs, but, I will go Bama. It's so hard to pick against.
Yeah, it really is. And for me, it's not even that hard at all in this particular instance because Fromm is tailor-made for Alabama. You know, the kind of quarterback that hurts Alabama, as you know, is the Deshaun Watson mobile kind of quarterback, the guy who gets out and is a run-pass option threat. And Fromm is just that typical drop-back kid, a freshman who's going to drop back in the pocket and make – predominantly safe throws. He doesn't throw a ton down the field. He isn't that kind of dual threat that has caused Saban's defense's problems in the last couple of years. So I really think this is going to be Alabama winning yet another championship. And Jim Harbaugh wishes he would have a chance at that. That's where we'll end it. Anthony Broom, thanks so much for your time. Keep up the great work at maizeandbrew.com. We tell everybody who's a Michigan fan, if you're looking for great coverage, you'll find it at maizeandbrew.com. Anthony, thanks again. We'll chat with you again real soon.
No problem, guys. Thanks again. Stay warm.
Yeah, we're trying our best. You do the same. that's going to be that's a tall order right now, and it will be for the next several days from what we understand. All right, good stuff there from Anthony Broom. Hey, Kush, do you have sitting on your desk right now a Sweet Deal of the Week gift certificate?
I do indeed.
I think I saw that somewhere, and didn't it say something like our ticket sweet deal of the week is a $50 gift certificate to Perry's Burgers on 220 220 Louisiana Avenue in, of course, Perrysburg?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you know that you could log on to 106ThatTicket.com tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock and get a $50 gift certificate to Perry's Burgers for just $25? That's half price. Did you know that?
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I have decided I like this so much, I'm going to give that $50 gift certificate away not for $25, not for $10, not even for $5. I'm going to give one away for free right now. It is our ticket sweet deal of the week, $50 gift certificate to Perry's Burgers. It's yours if you're caller number 7. To 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, and we will set you up at Perry's Burgers. Toledo Rockets head coach on the basketball side, Todd Kowalczyk, waiting in the wings to talk hoops with us after a split of their last two games between Penn and the MAC season starting out against Buffalo. That conversation with Coach Kowalczyk is directly around the corner right here on the ticket.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And we roll onward with the extravaganza now at 4:41. Thanks for being with us. Good conversation with Anthony Broom of maizeandbrew.com. Also appreciated Dennis Maniloff in hour number one. Time to get away from the oblong object and get to round ball basketball style on the college game. Toledo Rockets split their last two games, went on the road out in Philadelphia and beat Penn before coming back and starting up in Buffalo. I shouldn't say coming back, but moving on. And starting their MAC season with a 104-94 loss to Buffalo, and joining us now to talk about it in advance of tomorrow's game at Savage against the Akron is Rockets head coach Todd Kowalczyk. Coach, how are you, sir?
Doing fine, guys. How are you doing?
We are doing well, thank you. Happy New Year to you. So glad to get 2018 underway, and I know you're going to be glad to get back home with an opportunity to play in front of the fans of the Rockets at Savage tomorrow against Akron. But let's go back and look at the week that was and start, of course, on the plus side, which is the win at Penn. We had talked about, I think we talked to you from the arena or somewhere close to
yep.
it. Last week, and indeed, a nice win over a solid Ivy League club. Tell us about that one.
Well, I thought, the first half, we really defended. I thought the whole game, I liked how we guarded in that game. Not happy with our offensive execution, in the first half. And it wasn't turnovers. It was just shot selection. We took some, some quick shots or ill-advised shots. And because of that, I think we were down four at halftime and had a tremendous second half and ended up winning, you know, by 12, 13 points on the road at a, you know, against a really good team. You know, and it was a great win to do it in the Palestra and do it with the history of that building. It was a great experience for our guys.
And obviously it would have been nice to follow that one up with a win in the first MAC game of the season against Buffalo, but my goodness, protecting the basketball. We talk about this all the time. I think every coach talks about the need to protect the basketball and to not have a lot of turnovers, but 16 of them was enough to undo a pretty good offensive effort in a 104-94 loss. What happened? What was the key to the number of turnovers?
Well, I think in the first half we had 11 of them. You know, it was the first half turnovers for that. You know, bad passes that led to, you know, layups going the other way, you know, and just some basic fundamental mistakes, you know, and got into it. You know, we were up for a good part of the first half and let them go on a run because we gave them some easy baskets in transition, which, you know, and they are a very, very talented offensive team. They don't need any help by us making poor decisions in offense and fuel their fire. But it was a classic shootout. Both teams shot 54% from the floor. You know, we won the rebound battle. Unfortunately, we lost the turnover battle, and that was the difference along with our missed free throws. And, you know, we missed, you know, we prided ourselves, you know, in time of being a really good foul shooting program and not turning the ball over. And in that game, those two things impacted the game and we also had a really hard time, you know, keeping their guards out of the paint, you know, off of ball screens. You know, our ball screen defense wasn't very good out on top. You know, we tried different things. You know, obviously we got Luke Kanapke and Taylor Hadaway, and they have, an exceptional point guard that just became eligible transfer from Missouri. You know, that's only a one semester player for me. He's a senior right now for him. And, you know, we had a hard time keeping them out of the lane. You know, they had just high ball screens, very simple offense. And, I think our post guys probably came up a little bit too high and didn't protect the rim. And, when it gets, you know, past the second line of defense, it wasn't good for us. We should have kept Luke a little bit lower and just had him try to block some shots and, you know, and forced him into difficult twos, which is that mid-range game.
We are talking Toledo basketball with head coach Todd Kowalczyk. And Rockets fans, by the way, do not forget, by the time we're done with this interview, we are going to set you up with a pair of tickets tomorrow to go see Toledo against Akron at Savage. And, in fact, we've got a pair of club seats with a parking pass for you. So very nice little prize for you. We'll give away at the end of this interview before we are done at 5 o'clock. So make sure that you stick around for that. Coach, just real quick, going back to the turnovers, you know, when you talk about bad passes leading to fast breaks and easy layups going the other way, there are bad passes and there are bad passes. What I mean by that is there are bad lazy passes and then there are bad passes that are just bad decisions because somebody sees a lane, sees an opening, place where they can thread a needle, and they try it and it doesn't work. It's an aggressive mistake, maybe a careless one, but not a lazy bad pass. What kind of passes are we talking about?
Bad decisions. Bad decisions is what it was. I mean, you know, and there was, you know, we had three turnovers. You know, back to back to back, you know, Taylor Hadaway in transition, you know, takes two dribbles and he tries to outlet to Jalen Sanford. They pass, you know, good defensive play on their part, but it's a bad decision on Taylor's play on part. You know, the next time down, you know, Dylan Alderson has a 50-50 ball that, you know, kind of bobbles it and the kid just rips him, which leads to transition. Then we had a set play. They jumped on the reversal pass, you know, and bad decision by Willie Jackson to throw it to Nate Amigato. And to be honest, you have bad setup and timing by Nate. He was open too early. Willie didn't get it to him on time. And, it was a bad timing play, but those are the type of passes that I'm talking about. And I wish I could say it's one guy and Bob, 16 turnovers is not an alarming. Now we have teams in our league that average 16. It's not an alarming number, but we pride ourselves in trying to be under 10 in particular games. But, you know, 11 in the first half is just way, way too many.
Well, and not only that, you know, when both teams are shooting as well as you were, as you point out, 54% as a team, both sides, both the teams did very well from beyond the arc. In fact, you guys had more. That's when the turnovers can be the difference, as well as, and you pointed out foul shooting too, and I'm just looking at it, almost identical in terms of opportunities, 31 to 30, but they made 27 of their 31, and you made 18 of the 30, and that, of course, is, you know, the difference in the game, really, and it's kind of a cliche thing to say, how do you get better at that? You guys as a team are a 75% shooting free throw shooting team going into this one. Is it just one of those games where, you know, where it was contagious, that guys pressed a little bit too much at the line?
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, you know, Morion Jackson missed two foul shots the entire season. Now, he doesn't get to the line all that often, but he was 0 for 3. You know, Trayshawn Fletcher, you know, missed some foul shots in that game. And, you know, he's either really, really good from the foul line, or if he misses one or two, it kind of affects him a little bit. But, you know, that's an area that, they're called free throws for a reason. You know, you got to make them. You know, and 75% for us is I still think a low number. We're better than that, you know, and we've had some guys that need to step up and go up there and make, and three of those were front ends in the second half. You know, we cut the lead, you know, we're down two with 8 minutes to play and we missed a front end. It happened several times to us in that game. And, but you, when you have a game where one team shoots 30, one team shoots 31, it's going to be a high-scoring game. If you think about it this way, guys, I mean, that now you're scoring with no time coming off the clock. You know, so it's a high possession. We had 20 more possessions in that game than we did against the Penn game. It was a fast-paced game.
Yeah, and no doubt about it. And you're right. When you get to score with the clock stopped, it's going to lead to some high numbers. And indeed, it was 104-94. Rockets now 8-6 after that loss, 0-1 in the MAC, obviously. And tomorrow, it's Akron, who is 7-6, also lost their first game in the MAC. Can you give us a little bit of a preview, a scouting report on the Zips?
Well, they're relatively young. They have a graduate transfer. Their starting point guard came from Oregon State as a one-year guy, talented point guard. They only have, three or four guys returning from the program from last year. So they have an influx of talent there, but they are a team that plays really hard, plays, man-to-man defense, that will play some 1-3-1 zone that I'm sure we'll see. John Gross is their new head coach, who we're familiar with, because he was at Ohio University, for 4 or 5 years when we first got here. But they are a team that I think is dangerous. They're a team that is athletic and plays in transition.
So, Coach, looking ahead now at the, now that the non-conference schedule is behind you, and you look at what you have coming up, Akron is followed by Western Michigan, who is one of the favorites, I think, projected to be one of the favorites, one of the better teams in the conference, and then Central, and then Ohio. Just the early start of the MAC schedule, how confident do you feel that you can get out here and get some W's and get back on the right side of things in the conference win-loss record?
Well, I've said all along, I really enjoy coaching this team. I mean, we went and played at Buffalo, obviously disappointed with the outcome. Got back at, 3:30 in the morning on Wednesday morning. Had a film session Wednesday afternoon, and, the guys couldn't have had better energy today, in practice. They respond, they bring enthusiasm, they root for each other. It's really a fun team to be around. Going to practice today was awesome. I mean, they competed, they got better. So I think when you have a team like that, to answer your question, we feel we'll continue to get better and we feel we can be there at the end of the season and be competing for a championship.
Coach Todd Kowalczyk joining us to talk about Toledo basketball. Jim Christian wants to talk to you about something that is very pertinent here, and that is defense. When you do have a fast-paced game and you give up 104, it does beg questions about the defensive game plan going forward. Jimmy, what do you got?
And my question on this, Coach, is this more of a, just guys making mistakes out there in individual games, or is this something that you're at practice maybe tinkering with some defensive philosophies or things like that, or is this just kind of a game-by-game in terms of the defensive game plan for your guys?
Well, obviously the defensive game plan, against Buffalo didn't work. We got to do a better job the next time we face them to keep them out of the lane on their top ball screen. That's really what the story of that game was. But if you look at the previous games, you know, Penn, we held them to 43%. We shoot 53%. It's a 10% differential there. You know, Cleveland State, we held them to 39%. We shoot 53%. There's 14% difference there. Jackson State shot 32%. We shot 45%. And you know, Wright State, obviously a home loss and a bad loss for us. It wasn't the defense in that game. We held them to 42%. You know, so I'm not going to be alarmed by one game. Now, obviously, we need to work at that and get better at it. But I think this team has gotten better defense. And you look at the five, and I've told you guys many times, I look at the five-game stats. Our five-game stats, you know, over those last five games, you know, are actually pretty good. We're holding teams to 42%, and we're shooting 49%, so that's a plus 7. And our three-point field goal percentage is actually a plus 12. We're shooting 43%, and our opponents are shooting 30%. That's 13% difference.
So those are indeed good indicators, no question about it, that the defense is right. And you're right. You don't you can't overreact to either to one great game defensively or one game in which you do get a high scoring game like you just did against Buffalo. Look at that.
Yeah,
I like that five game thing that you've always done. Yeah.
You know, we got into a shootout. You know, and two good offensive teams. Both teams executed at a high level, and you know, again, we both it was not like this game was right there till the end. We're down two with 5 minutes to play. We just didn't make some plays down the stretch and primarily at the defensive end. And that's where we got to get those key stops. And in the other games we did against Penn, we got those stops. Cleveland State, we did. But obviously the Buffalo game means more because it's a conference game and it's on the road. And our turnovers those are correctable things, the passing things. We have 66 turnovers over our last, five games. So we got to get that number down.
No question about it. If the goal is to keep it under 10, that is certainly a great place to start. Starting tomorrow against those Akron Zips. Hey, Coach Kowalczyk, before you go, what's your favorite number between 1 and 10?
4.
Caller number 4 is going to be the guy. Coach Kowalczyk has set the mark. Caller number 4 to 866-240-1065. We'll go and see his Rockets at Savage tomorrow against Akron with a pair of club seats and a parking pass included in this giveaway right now. Caller number 4, it is yours. Coach Kowalczyk, best of luck against the Zips. And then next week, of course, we'll talk to you again and hopefully be talking about another winning streak.
Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you so much, Coach. There you go, Coach Todd Kowalczyk joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The ticket, we wrap that with, indeed, the giveaway of those tickets. So enjoy that. Should be an awful lot of fun. Game is, what time is that game, Kush? I thought I had it, and I guess I do not. I want to say it was a 7 o'clock game, but I guess I don't have that here. Kush is probably talking to caller number 4 right now, who is our winner. But he is going to, speaking of winners, my apologies to Patrick. Patrick Miller of Berkey was our winner of our sweet deal of the week. We had a sweet deal giveaway right before the bottom of the hour the bottom of the hour break. We had a sweet deal winner to Perry's Burgers in Perrysburg. We got a $50 gift certificate to him, and you can get a $50 gift certificate to Perry's Burgers for just $25 tomorrow morning when they go on sale on our website at 1065theticket.com at 9 a.m. while supplies last, of course. So good luck to you on that. And that is going to do it. We are out of time right here on The Ticket. We've got Drive Time coming your way with Mike Miller out for the week. You do have Jim Cushlin sitting in once again, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy that. Thanks so much for being a part of the show. Thanks to my guest, Dennis Maniloff. Thanks to Anthony Broom of Maize and Brew. And thanks, of course, to Coach Todd Kowalczyk. And that's it. Tomorrow is a free-for-all Friday edition of the Extravaganza right here on The Ticket. So make sure you're back with us for that one. And until then, have yourself a great night. Stay here for Drive Time. We'll see you.